Hello, and welcome back to Spaces Unscripted. I'm your host, Alyssa Esposito. On Spaces Unscripted, we talk all things creative. And today I'm joined with the most special of guests, my brother, Gary Esposito. Gary, I will let you give a proper intro to yourself because I just feel like I have to. So tell us a little bit about what you do, maybe a little brief overview, and then we'll really dive into it, and I'll start
questioning you. Thank you for having me. It's very cool. Yeah, so I do a little bit of everything. So I'm my background is in architecture proper. I guess my official title is a designer. Work on interior architecture, exterior design, AI. You kind of name it, we kind of do it. So I guess, overall designer would be the kind of title.
All the design things.
Yeah.
I'm going to pretend like I don't know these answers as we're going into the questions. And maybe I don't. Maybe some of them I won't know what the answers will be. But I'm going to pretend like I'm not your little sister.
Sure.
And that I'm a stranger who's interviewing you. So to start off, if anybody's connecting the dots here, this is the reason that I'm in the design field would be the person sitting next to me right now. I don't think I've ever met somebody who, I wish I had it in front of me, but there is a school project that I found of my brother's when he was in eighth grade, I want to say. And it said, what do you want to be when you grow up? And again, going back, the whole premise of this podcast is how you blend worlds together and getting to where you are now. But it said, what do you want to be when you grow up? And he said, I'd like to be a professional baseball player, but realistically, I'd like to be an architect. So here we are.
Yeah.
I really wish I had it. Maybe I'll be able to find it and plug it in. But yeah.
A realist even back then.
Yeah, a realist from eighth grade. Like, not somebody, I want to be an astronaut. No, he's like, I want to be a professional baseball player, but maybe not. So take us back to the beginning.
Sure.
The whole spiel. Take us back to where you started from young,
yep,
all the way up until how you got into architecture and your journey along the way, baseball. Take me through all of it.
Yeah, so born in New York, we moved around a lot when I was young. My parents always were moving towards bigger and better houses. So we were doing, which we didn't realize at the time was called a live and flip. And we would live in the house. We would live through the construction and then we'd flip the house and make a bunch of money and go into a bigger house.
We thought our mom just really loved changing
right.
the look of our house
yeah.
and wanted to move.
But at the time, they didn't realize what they were doing, but it was, now we know it's called the live and flip. And it was, building equity into the house and constantly rolling that into the next house. But born in New York, then moved to Florida at an early age. Always loved to play baseball. Grew up a big Yankee fan. Loved playing baseball. It was kind of everything. Eat, sleep, and breathe baseball, and always liked to draw on the side, but that was always kind of like a side thing.
Sometimes
that I liked
on
to do.
Walls when he was
right.
little.
Yes, any
Popeye.
Kind of medium,
yeah.
including walls. and so I always, wanted to become the next, famous baseball player, but I liked to do this drawing stuff on the side. So I went to high school in Florida, and there was a magnet program within one of the high schools, and they offered architecture, and one of the guidance counselors said, oh, you like to draw, maybe this is something that you'd like to do. So that was my first kind of taste of architecture, and I really enjoyed it. Took a couple classes, learned CAD, very kind of high level overview, but really gravitated towards it. And that's that was 9th grade 10th grade. So I knew that that was always a possible path, but, baseball was kind of the main thing. I always kept my grades higher because I knew that they would afford me the opportunity to go to schools that other kids weren't able to go to. Mm-hmm. So I used the grades and the GPA as a foot in the door into schools that I knew maybe the talent pool wasn't as good in baseball. So I, you know, always kept that. But it was a means to an end for me, that it was always a means in which to go to and play baseball. Anyway, I was looking to go to school on the West Coast. I looked at probably the number one school on the West Coast for architecture, got into that architecture program. They're also a Division I baseball program. And I called the coach and said, I got in. He said, great, this is wonderful. We can't wait to have you. And he said, you know, by the way, what are you going to be studying? And I said, architecture. And he said, nope, can't do that.
So actually, you're not coming here.
He said, no, you can't. He said, well, I've had, you know, another player who was an engineer. We never saw him. He lived under the desk. Like, it's too demanding. Our schedule, that schedule is too demanding. It's never going to work.
Right.
And I said, you don't know me. Right. I could do anything. I could do
which would have been true. Which little did he know? I mean, you could have done it if anybody.
Yeah.
Done
so
it, you could have done
but
it.
But he didn't want it. He wanted me to change my major. I said no. And so I decided to go to a school locally for 1 year and redshirt, you know, kind of figure out where should I go? What should I do? They didn't have architecture. So I did art as a kind of you know, thing to basically just keep me busy at the time and figure out what I was going to do. So then I looked back on the East Coast to transfer to a college. I was looking at Division I programs. I got a scholarship to come to a school in the Northeast. I had to change from being a middle infielder to a catcher, which at that level is very difficult. It was a bad fit. The coach was leaving at the time. He didn't tell us until we basically got there. You know, it was freezing cold. Again, they didn't offer architecture, so I was doing whatever, you know, on the side just to get the baseball.
Jeez, yeah.
Right. And it just was a horrible fit. A new coach came in. It was horrible. You know, he cleaned house. He brought all his new guys in. So I went back to Florida and regrouped and said, I'm not going to settle on giving up the architecture. I want both. I want architecture and baseball. So I looked back on the West Coast, and there was really only one program that had was Division I, had the baseball, needed a catcher, had the architecture, would let me do architecture and baseball, and that was the University of San Diego. So it really selected itself at the end. So I transferred, went to USD.
The weather wasn't bad.
Weather was perfect, 75 and sunny every day. Basically, and lived in paradise for 3 years. Completed an undergraduate in arts with an architecture major.
Mm-hmm.
But the thing was is that it did not offer a degree in which you can go immediately into your master's and do a one-year master's.
Got it.
So with this degree that I got from San Diego, I needed to go to a school for 3.5 years post undergrad. So I applied to, you know, a bunch of different schools at the same time. I'm trying out for like the Phillies and this one and that one. And I said, well, if I get into one of the colleges for the master's program that I want to, one of these five schools, I'll go.
Mm-hmm.
If not, I'll figure it out and, you know, maybe I'll do something else, play minors or independent ball or something to kind of keep that going. And then ended up getting into two of those programs that I wanted to, and ended up selecting Cornell University for my master's program. Went to Cornell in 2015, started there.
Wow.
And
that was 10 years ago.
Yeah.
Oh my God.
Went fast. And was all into the architecture. And it was a good transition because I was ending baseball and that world in which I was so hyper-focused and enthralled and engulfed in it, and had to jump right into another field that was all-encompassing, all involved, so that, you know, I didn't have time to
think about the
think
loss
about,
of,
this trying to transition. It was, I had to go right into this new demanding
I think
field.
That's why we had a harder time with it it seemed like at the time than you did. Because
right.
as yeah. a family, we had spent, you know, my whole life going to baseball games and doing all of this. And then it was just, you know, onto this next amazing chapter. But we were like, whoa, whoa, wait, whoa, whoa, wait, whoa, whoa, whoa.
Yeah,
and he's like, come on. Yep. And we were all kind of like.
So, yeah, there was no time to mourn the loss of one, and because you had to go immediately into the next, which ended up probably
which ended
being
up
the best
being
thing.
Amazing. Yeah. Yeah.
So I was at Cornell. At Cornell, you do one semester. It was a 3.5-year program. One of the semesters, they make you come to the city,
mm-hmm.
live in the city, do professional practice, do a studio here. We were living on the Upper East Side, me and two of the other guys. But we'd have to commute down, so you get to feel of the city life and that yep. kind of thing. And one of the very prominent architecture firms here in the city was our professional practice. So we mm-hmm. would go, you know, every like Tuesday and Thursday and have classes there, and they teach you all about the practice.
Mm-hmm.
And it was interesting, eye-opening, and you know, hear from the principals and, you know, everybody in the architecture firm. And one day they took us and said, look, we're going to set you up with one of our architects mm-hmm. in-house. And you could ask them anything you want, and you could, you know, pick their brain. Nothing's off limits. And, you know, this is your first foray for some of you into the practice.
Yep.
So I sat, and two of my other classmates sat across from a gentleman. He was like in his mid-50s and had been working at the firm for, I don't know, 20 years or something like that. And so we asked him everything. And one of the last things I asked him was, when does like the all-nighters stop? Because that's one thing in architecture that you pull all-nighters. It's just par for the course.
Yeah.
You can't fake it. You have to draw it. So, and it takes time. And so, you know, my question was like, when does that stop? Because especially at school, it's nonstop. You're always doing it.
Yep.
I would actually flip my schedule. So I would basically go into the studio, go to class, have lunch, do some work, eat dinner, and then immediately go to bed
mm-hmm.
because I knew I would be hitting a wall
right after
yeah. dinner. So I would just accept it, go to sleep.
Smart.
And then wake up around 2 o'clock in the morning.
Smart.
And start my work again because I'd feel the pressure of the deadline coming.
Right.
And nobody's up, so there's nobody to
bother you. Yes, you have your own time.
So I was just in my own zone.
Yeah, makes sense.
Anyway, so I'm sitting across from this architect. I asked him that question, when does the all-nighter stops? And he said, no, not really ever. He says, you know, I just, for example, we were doing a competition and the other night, and, you know, it takes all night, and we have to send it in to get the bid. And he said, you know, I went back on the train and the guys were coming into work and I was leaving work.
You're like, what?
Yeah, and he was like, but they're very nice and they gave me the day off the next day because they understood.
Right.
And I panicked.
Yeah.
I went into complete panic mode right after that. And then we had to sit down, the whole class, with the principal head of the firm. And I asked, how do you move up quickly in architecture? And he said, you know, either you become an old man like me and you've been here, you know, forever and you're 75 and now you've become a principal, or you bring us business.
Mm-hmm.
And so I did the math and I said, well, I don't have any rich family members that I'm going to bring business and be able to build some huge tower.
Right.
That's number one. And number two, I don't want to wait till I'm 75 to, you know, kind of make anything of myself in that.
Yep.
I went and worked at an architecture firm here in the city, and I realized that the architect was doing iterations of what the developer wanted him to do, and the developer was really the one sitting at that other side of the table that was making a lot of decisions. So I started to say, well, maybe I should do architecture. Should I not do architecture? I don't know. This is kind of making me nervous of what I'm hearing. So I immediately freaked out, pivoted, and said, well, maybe I should do tech because architecture and technology are intertwined. So I called up. Cornell Tech was being built on Roosevelt Island, and I called up and I said, can I, you know, start classes immediately? And they said, we haven't even built the buildings yet.
Calm down.
You're like 3 years ahead of time.
Yeah.
Call us in like 3 years. And I said, oh, my God. Like, all right, well, that's out. I can't do that.
I'm done.
Yeah. So I was in class and finishing up in the studio here in the city. Had an amazing professor. We're doing our final. Everybody's like half dead because we haven't slept.
Right.
And in the next room adjacent to our room, there's another final going on of real estate development. Okay. And so I peeked my head in there and I'm looking around and they've got like a flyer. And so they give me a flyer and I'm like, okay, I don't know what this is. I don't know anything. So anyway, so the next semester we go back to Ithaca.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, well, I got this flyer for this Baker School of Real Estate. Maybe I'll do some real estate development. So I'll be a major in architecture and get my master's, but I'll do like a kind of minor in real estate development.
Right.
So I go in, I start taking a couple classes. It's all like they're speaking gibberish. You know, what is the NOI of this return of this BOE? And I don't know what's going on. And but it's all, you know, related to architecture, but it's not architecture, but it's a different world. And so I start asking a lot of the TAs that had architecture backgrounds. I said, well, you know, you guys transitioned from architecture to real estate development. Why did you do that? What are you seeing? And they all kind of had a common thread. And they all said, well, we're sitting on the wrong side of the table when it comes to decision making. Unfortunately, is, you know, the architect is, you know, for hire, whereas the developer is the one, you know, really putting the pieces together and has the financing and that kind of thing. So mm-hmm. I thought that was interesting. And one of the TAs said, you know, you should really try to do this ULI competition. So I said, okay, I don't know what that is. But she said, well, it's a team. Let me introduce you to this guy. So me and this guy start talking. And he says, well, you know, I'm putting together a team of like 5 students from city planning, architecture, and real estate development.
Mm-hmm.
And we're going to do this competition. We're not going to win, like no big deal, but it should be fun. Whatever. If we win like 10 grand each, whatever. We're not going to win. Harvard's going to win or Columbia's going to win. But we'll try anyway. And basically, we just have to spend our spring break. We have to knock it out. They give us a site. They release it all on the same day. You have like 5 days to come up and draw and do a back of envelope, whole pro forma to back up all of your thoughts and ideas, and you send it in. It's blind. We don't put anybody's name on it.
And it's just, yeah.
And we have judges, and it all goes to Washington, D.C., and they pick a final 4.
I didn't know that.
And so we sent in our boards. We got it in like the night before. We sent it in tubes. We were like, all right, well, that was fun. We'll see you guys
never thought of it again. Yeah.
Yeah. And lo and behold, we get a email like 3 weeks later. You guys have been selected in the final 4 of the ULI competition. So we're like, okay, now
yeah.
what?
Yeah.
So we ended up going to the site. They flew us all out to Toronto, where the site was that year. We walked the site. We stayed over. We asked questions. We meet professionals, whatever, yeah. blah, blah, blah. And we come back, and they give us another 2 weeks or so to kind of revamp your proposal based on what you've learned.
Right.
And you have to now have new boards made, new renderings.
So it was a whole new, you had to have a whole new.
No, it's the same site, but you have to have an updated now.
New presentation. Got it. Okay.
Based on that. And it needs to have a booklet with all of this. So anyway, we pull all-nighters. We do everything. We fly out to Toronto.
Okay.
And we actually go into this building called the Hudson's Bay building, and we go upstairs and we go into this thing, and we're there, and there's 9 judges all sitting there, and Gerald Hines is there of Hines Real Estate Development, and we do our spiel. We go out, right? We're all sitting there. It's us and 3 other teams that all tried, and they called our name, and we won. We won the whole thing.
Like, I told you.
Yeah, no clue what we were doing, but we won the whole thing.
Like, you sure?
Yeah.
You sure?
And that was our first kind of, or my first, at least, you know, kind of movement into the real estate development side.
That was my next question, was how did you transition into that?
Yeah.
Which I guess this was the moment.
This was it. Yeah. Yeah. So the ULI, you know, was kind of started the push. I then went and finished, you know, most of my Cornell experience. Went and did worked for a real estate developer out in LA.
Mm-hmm.
We worked on a retail project, and at the same time, Palisades Village, and worked on the same time at the Montecito Rosewood Hotel.
Mm-hmm.
So I would go back and forth, learning hotel, you know, development, and the retail development at the same time, while also touring all the different sites that he had.
Not much.
And said, okay, this is the path I want to take, is real estate development. Not, I'd rather be, and my whole thesis was, if these are the guys that are actually making the decision, and most of these guys have a finance background,
mm-hmm.
There should be some creative architect, designer that is sitting next to them that's helping their decision making when it comes to these big projects.
Sure.
And they're not just leaning on the architects that they're hiring.
Mm-hmm.
So I said, okay, I'm going to work for a developer. I think I'm going to go back to LA. I'll work for the guy that I worked for before. He was done with his projects. He wasn't bringing on any new designers at the time. And so I started applying in New York, and I started applying. I'm sending out my resume. I'm not really hearing back. And then I hear back from this company, the Hudson's Bay Company, which I didn't even know what that was. Like, okay, I guess, you know.
Not connecting any dots.
No dots at all.
Not any dots.
And I'm like, all right, the Hudson's Bay Company, I guess I'll go. They need the junior architect. So I go on a couple interviews, and I'm going to the first interview over the phone, and the HR person is talking to me, and she's explaining, and she says, XYZ, blah, blah, blah. And our founder, you know, Richard Baker, who, you know, purchased the Hudson's Bay and Saks Fifth Avenue. And I was like,
la, la, la,
I
la,
think that's the same guy of the Baker program where I just graduated Cornell.
While you're in real time.
So in real time, I'm interviewed. Like Googling, you know, is this the same
is
Richard
this the
Baker?
Same man?
And it ends up being, and then immediately, so I said, yeah, you know, I graduated from the Baker program. And
right.
So, yeah, I mean, it was very serendipitous. I got the job and have been there now 6 years. And, you know, where we held the OLI competition
was
the Hudson's Bay building in Toronto.
Yep.
It wasn't until I flew back there.
Yeah, I've been here before.
three years later, yeah, we were closing. Richard was closing on the Hudson's Bay right before COVID, taking the Hudson's Bay company private, that I put the pieces together and said, oh my God, full circle, I'm back where it kind of started.
Yeah.
So
it all blended together.
Yep,
it all meshed together.
That was the journey.
Yeah, yeah. And there's definitely pieces where, you know, there's a 7-year age gap between us. So I think there's pieces where, and now being 27 and hearing it, it's like, oh. But I think, you know, 14, 15, 16 years old, I wasn't really thinking
right.
of you sleep. I mean, I remember you sleeping under desks and doing all of the hard stuff, but it wasn't until now that I'm like, oh, there's a lot that I missed probably.
Yeah.
Yeah. So you've had a lot of transitions, both in where you've lived career-wise and how you've gotten to now. So would you say, obviously looking back when you were doing baseball, if you were to project where you are now being in design,
mm-hmm.
would you have thought that this was where you would be? Would you look at yourself back when you were in Dunedin days?
Yeah.
Or mm-hmm. whenever, would you look ahead and say, oh wow, I'll be doing, would you even have thought real estate development?
No. I mean, the eighth grade version of me thought there was
the
something
eighth grade
to do
version
with
knew.
Architecture
but not,
and
not
design, but I didn't even know what it was. But no, because I don't think I knew the compartments of what it takes to actually build something is very much different than I think most people realize.
Yeah.
I thought an architect goes and draws the building, and somehow, some way, it's built, and there's a contractor, and, you know, and there it is. But, you know, there's, you know, has to be the financing portion of this, you know, is probably the most, or one of the most important aspects of the whole project. And that's why I think the developer, you know, needs a designer kind of in his ear or his right hand, because, you know, they're the ones really getting the money together, whether they're putting in their own equity or, you know, financing. And but they really need, they have a lot of skin in the game. And if they don't have the design prowess to kind of know what's the right move, then they're always going to be value engineering the project just to make sure the numbers pencil.
Right.
But there is a lot of value add to design, which is hard to quantify because it's a, you know, a qualitative field. But you know, anybody knows when they feel good when they walk into a space versus not even realizing what's going on around them because they're in their own world, right? So, and, you know, that could be, you know, the difference in rents that you're getting, you know, from your retail vendors, or your price per square foot that you're charging at the condo, right? Design has a lot, you know,
to do with those.
To do, I mean, you know, I think that it could change your, you know, performas, you know, in the positive direction just from design choices and having the right design team, and, you know, making sure that you have the A team for the AOR that's doing it, or the GC, and catching things and not having as many change orders, and doing it right the first
making
time.
Making sure it's right the first round.
So, so makes no, sense. I don't think I would have ever said
seen
real
all that.
Estate
you wouldn't have known.
Yeah, I had no idea.
Very true. What do you think the biggest challenge, I guess, I would say overall, if you could pinpoint one of the biggest, either like a pivot or something that was the biggest challenge so far, what would you say that that would be?
Probably two moments. The first moment was when I graduated from San Diego, right? Baseball was kind of somewhat in the sunset, you know, of my time, whereas architecture was just kind of on the sunrise in a sense. But I had to choose, you know, which route to take.
Path to go down.
Yeah, that was difficult. So I think, you know, and advice for anybody, you know, in sports, you know, whether in D1, D2, D3, whatever, is to always have a backup plan. You know, nobody ever tells you kind of when you're going through it what the actual probability is.
Yeah.
You know, it's something like 0.00001% of
you don't hear it. It goes
are,
in one and out
right,
the other.
But, and you always think, well, I'm going to be the, you know, difference guy. It's not going to pertain to me. And I was always glad that I had the architecture as a backup.
Yep.
Because it allowed to take the pressure off of that in a sense, but it gave me something else to fall back on. And I see a lot of people that didn't have that.
Yep.
Spent, you know, 30, you know, 25 years in, you know, let's call it one sport, baseball, let's just say. And that's all they can now go to.
Yeah.
It's all they know. And it's too late to kind of try to reinvent themselves.
Yeah.
So they stick with it.
Yep.
You know, coaching or whatever, which, you know, a lot of people have great careers doing that. But some people are, you know, kind of forced into that. So, you know, anybody that has the ability to kind of have a backup and be a multi-dimensional person, I think that's, you know, the way you should go.
Well, I think that's for a lot of fields too. I mean, I think in any career, look at, you know, acting.
Sure.
And our parents have always, we were very lucky in the sense that our parents were very supportive in anything that we wanted to do, and like no dream is too big. And that's a wonderful thing to have that, but it's also scary because then as you get older and, you know, you hit a point where you're like, what about money? Then, you know, it is scary transitioning, but we've been very lucky to have parents who have supported us fully and have always, those dreams that are so big, didn't really, they felt normal. Like baseball, acting. Right. Like, it was just, yeah, that's what our, you know, our parents supported us in it. So,
right. And I guess just to answer the second part was, the transition from architecture to real estate development was the next.
That was another pivot.
Because that is a different language.
Yep.
So, you know, kind of using right brain, left brain kind of, you know, it's because it's very different finance, you know, versus design and how do the two. And you never really have to deal with that in architecture school. They never put design finances as one of your constraints.
Right.
You know, because
it's
other
not your
constraints,
concern.
Site constraints, X, Y, and Z. But which I understand, I think, in the early parts of architecture school, why they don't do that. They want to kind of have a very plastic brain in which they're able to mold, you know, you to rethink and change, but change your thinking. But I think later on, it's a constraint that should, you know, be put on to students so that they can, you know, also use that as a way in which to be creative. So
very nice. I had a whole list. Don't worry.
Okay.
So, two things. First thing would be, have you received any advice from anybody? I know you're talking about the architect that you sat in front of back with before ULI.
Yep.
But I don't know if this will apply. Has there been any advice that you've received from anybody that you would pass on or that has stuck with you?
Yeah, I think working for, you know, the firm I'm with now, you know, I work kind of in a small team of designers that, you know, we don't know what's coming through the door every day. So we're designing, one day we're designing office towers sitting on top of historic buildings. The next we're designing, you know, office spaces and co-working spaces. And the next day we're designing actual furniture. And then we're doing AI videos.
It's such a cool, it's such a cool job.
So we're kind of doing everything. But I think, you know, something that I've learned is every problem has an answer. So, you know, thinking creatively on how to solve the issues and the problems is kind of the name of the game.
Mm-hmm.
In all fields.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's, you know, can you think creatively and be creative, and really have bought into the idea that every problem does have a solution. It's just, you know, how do you
find it?
Yeah.
Yeah. And turning your brain onto that.
Yeah.
What do you think so far is your favorite thing that you've worked on? Could be in school, could be now. What do you think your favorite project that's either inspired you or that's been like, this is why I do this?
Yeah. I don't know about a favorite project.
Or even just
like
a moment.
A favorite child. I guess. Like, don't want to, you know, all the other projects feel bad. I'll tell you one story, which was eye-opening. And then maybe, you know, one of the projects I've enjoyed being a part of. But so our first semester in Cornell, we go in, we're green. You know, we think we know about architecture and they're about to just, you know, blow our minds and change everything. And so we come in, there's, I don't know, about 10 of us in the class or 15. And they said, you know, welcome to architecture school. Had this great professor, two great professors. And one of the professors said, we're going to challenge you and we want to see what you guys create by tomorrow.
Mm-hmm.
They said, you know, you have to create a sphere and it has to be made out of paper. And
no pressure.
we're going to give each of you an animal. And we want you to embody that animal within this sphere.
This is feeling so much like acting class when they're like, be a donkey. And you're like, what?
Yeah. So, so everybody's getting selected. Who's the ostrich? Who's the spider? I got the crocodile.
Florida. They were like, and, crocodile.
Yeah, crocodile. And they said, okay, good luck. And that was it. We'll see you all tomorrow. So we're like scrambling. We're like crumpling paper up. What do we do? How do we make this a sphere? The kid's over there crying. This one's over there panicked. We're running over to Michael's. We don't know what we're looking at. And so, you know, it became this, you know, question of how do you do this? I had a little bit of background in, you know, Rhino 3D, which was a CAD program. And I worked with another professor that talked about polyhedral spheres. And so I knew there was a way to tessellate a sphere to make it sphere-like. It's not a perfect ball, but, you know, but if you can score in the laser cutter, you know, triangles basically into a piece of paper, you could fold it into a sphere.
Okay.
So, you know, I did that, you know, which was great. They loved that. And they said, okay, but how is this a crocodile? So, well, I don't know.
Scales.
It's the scales. And they were like, no, it's not the scales. There's other things that are scaled.
Yeah.
You know, tell us something about the crocodile. So I'm doing all this research.
Oh, God.
And I find out that it has one of the strongest bites in the animal kingdom. It's like the hippopotamus is like number one and crocodile is like number two.
Oh,
so
God.
I said, okay, the bite. And they said, great. Okay, so now make that sphere bite. So I'm like, I don't know what I'm doing.
What do you mean?
Like, I'm not sleeping. I'm under the desk. And anyway, so I figure out a way to make, when you put your hand in, you know, the tessellation, the triangles catch your hand and in a sense bite you, right, as you try to pull it out. So anyway, it was, this whole thing was actually a way to design, and we designed a zoo at the end of the semester.
Oh.
But the idea was learn the kind of what makes the animal, you know, learn about its habitat, learn about everything. And it really was, you know, very similar to learning your client, you know, learn everything that, you know, they can give you so that you could understand what environment they're going to like.
Very true.
Anyway, so that was a fun project. That
I love that. I don't want to make it about me, but I will for a second. I used to make furniture out of paper when I was little for my dollhouse. I don't know if you remember this, but I used to ask my mom for multiple sheets of paper and I would make furniture. It wasn't as cool as what you're talking about right now, but, you know.
Well, there you go.
Whatever.
So, but yeah, I mean, professionally, I mean, we work on so many projects. I mean, I don't know.
I think every project that you do is like, wow, like everything is so cool.
No,
so I don't know how you would pick.
Very cool. No, you learn something new about, you know, the built environment on each one. So I don't know if there's one specific.
One specific.
Yeah.
I like the paper crocodile story. That was a good one.
Yeah.
So outside, I know you, but outside of work, what would you say keeps you motivated or inspired or keeping on? Like, what do you think fuels you outside of work to keep going with work? I guess if that makes sense.
Yeah, I mean, I think I just genuinely enjoy, you know, good spaces and being in places that make you feel good. You know, growing up like we did and constantly moving, but always, you know, improving a kitchen or improving a bathroom and always seeing that, I think through osmosis, you know, definitely changed the thought process and
our brain chemistry.
Yeah. And so I will, you know, go out to eat, but I'll pick a place that's aesthetically pleasing and that feels good over the
food.
The food.
Yeah.
Because, you know, I'll remember sometimes the food, but most of the time I don't even remember the
food. That's so interesting.
But I remember, oh, that place was cool or that place was interesting.
Wow.
I just came back from Puerto Rico and we went to a place called La Factoria, which is a bar. And it's a bar, but then it's attached to another bar, attached to another bar. And you go through a series of rooms.
Wow.
Very gritty, very like, you know, factory-esque.
Yeah.
But it's a series of rooms, probably one of the coolest places I've been to, you know, recently. I can't tell you what I had to drink.
But you
I
could tell you what it looked like.
What it looked like and how it felt. And
did they let you take pictures?
No.
See, some of those places, they don't let you.
I mean, they might have, but I didn't take many. I just didn't feel right. But I mean, it was constant discovery. Like you open a door that says exit and it's actually another bar. That's so cool. And yeah, very cool.
Where would you say is, you've traveled a ton. Where would you say is the one place that's inspired you the most architecturally?
Yeah.
And just in work, and have you applied anything that you've taken from any of your travels and put it into
any of your projects? Think going to Italy and you know, traveling, seeing Rome. We did Rome, Naples. We did the coast, Positano. Mm-hmm. And you know, when you go into these villages that are very you know, tight and intimate and small, and there's stairs and there's places to discover and little plazas, I think that feel has made its way into a lot of the designs we do. You know, this kind of village feel, you know, bringing the scale down to a human scale. I, you know, have gone through many design kind of phases, and oh, at one point I really liked, you know, ultra modern.
Mm-hmm.
Then, you know, I kind of went into this kind of biophilic world.
Yeah.
And now I've kind of moved, you know, into other, you know, understanding the importance of brick and texture and scale and the intimacy of certain things. So
it's evolving.
It's evolving. Yep. But, you know, that was a great trip. And then to just go and see like masterworks of architecture.
Yeah.
You know, whether it be in San Diego, you know, places in New York and that kind of thing. So you try to grab all of these pieces.
Yeah.
And then when a new project comes, you have something from to bank. Grab from. Right.
Where do you think... Where do you think you see yourself moving in the next, I don't know, 5 to 10 years in terms of career? Do you see yourself staying in what you're doing now? Like, what do you think?
Yeah, I think what I've learned is through the process, you're your best client at the end of the day. I mean, you know, a lot of architects, interior designers, they are in a sense, you know, beholden to the client.
Mm.
And, you know, your whole day from day to day is really trying to move the client in a direction towards, you know, the right design. Right. And you're learning about the client's needs, but you're also trying to infuse a bit of yourself in that. And I've realized if you could just cut that person out and you be the client.
Yeah.
You know, you have one less person to try to convince that, you know, certain moves are the correct moves and that kind of thing. So, you know, hopefully the idea is to become your own client. So become your own developer, you know, so within 5, 10, 15 years, you have a certain number of your own projects under your belt.
Sure.
You know, and that you're able to develop. So.
That makes sense. And yep. I'm every day picking. It's like I have my own little built-in Wikipedia with him, because anything I don't know or any direction I don't know where to move, I'm calling him. So I'm very lucky in that sense. So did you see me, like, if you would have predicted years ago, see me getting into design?
No,
really?
No way. Yeah, no way.
Why?
I don't know. It just didn't seem like that was the route. always had a good eye, but I didn't think...
it's a little all over the place.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know.
Well, I was just so into acting.
Right. So that seeing that pivot never... You know, I never did 2+2 with that move, but, you know, looking back with creating furniture out of paper and that
Sims.
Kind of thing. Sims. Yeah, like, could have. Okay, I could see it.
Yeah.
But yeah, no, I'd really have to squint to kind of... see that
so
direction.
Funny. I don't know if I could have either. I mean, I've always, obviously, because of mom, I've always had, you know, I always wanted my room to look different every year. So I guess that could have been a precursor as to what was coming down the road. But that's really funny.
Yeah.
if you were to talk to your younger self, mm-hmm. younger Gary in, I don't know, high school, mm-hmm. What would you say? What advice would you give him? Just knowing everything that you know now, your whole journey, yeah. what would you tell him?
Look at the numbers, understand, you know, what the reality is. I think the eighth grade version of me that you brought up probably realized it, maybe saw the numbers and started to do the math. But, you know, for me, you know, a lot of people will always say, or, you know, you learn something from what you go through and there's building on it. And I think, you know, some of that has validity and some of that is, you know, just not knowing kind of what the lay of the land is.
Yeah.
And, you know, a lot of these, unfortunately, a lot of these programs are, you know, financially driven. So, you know, a lot of coaches won't tell you what it really is because they have a job and right, they're making, you know, money and, you know, they need to keep you on the Ferris wheel, right, in order to make a living and the next guy's coming right behind you, but he's got to keep that whole, you know, situation going, the whole story. He's got to keep the story going because the next person's going to also buy into this story. And, you know, there's a whole industry built on, you know, you buying into this story and continuing with this story. So I would just, you know, probably put something in front of them that showed them the numbers and said, look, here it is in black and white. Yeah, maybe you will, but maybe you won't. So, you know, make sure that you have your ducks in a row.
You have your backup.
Because chances are, probability is, it's not going to.
Big numbers guy.
Yeah.
Big numbers guy.
You know, because most people will look at that and they'll say, oh, there's a 0.01% chance that you make it in baseball or whatever it is. But you look at it the other way and you say there's a 99.9% chance that you're not going to make it.
Yeah.
So, you know, again, you know, follow your dreams, try, but, you know, have the backup. So
one final question. What do you think you took from all of the years? Baseball. What do you think you took from one career brought to the next?
I think it's a work ethic, which I think I've, you know, always had. I think you're just, most people are built with it. Either they are couch potatoes and don't want to. And a lot of those people actually, you know, they work smarter, not harder. So they'll figure out a way to, you know, have less effort, but get more done, which I think there's something to that. But this field, is for the, you know, we're going to wake up at 2 a.m. folks and do work. And
it's not for the weak.
Right.
Or the lazy.
Or the lazy, or, you know, the ones that don't want to live underneath the desk. But I think, you know, the work ethic, you know, you learn that from sports, you know, waking up and I don't feel like going and doing a whole workout at 6 a.m., but you have to, or you're going to get kicked off the team, right? So that builds that in you that you have to do it.
Yeah.
And you kind of carried that over, right? So, you know, sometimes you got to get up at 4 a.m. and get the presentation ready and, you know, have it
is what it is.
Done.
Yeah.
And, you know, you just kind of grin and bear it. So,
work ethic.
Yeah.
Awesome. I think that's all I'm going to harass you with for today.
Very good.
When this whole thing started being an idea in my brain, I was like, it has to be one of the first ones on because we're blood, but also I wouldn't be where I am if he hadn't done any of what he's doing because he's always been like the, all right, my parents are the most amazing, like, follow your dreams, and my brother's the one who's like, but what are you doing? A big numbers guy. So he's like, but what are you doing? So thank you for being here.
Sure.
Thank you for following all of my crazy dreams and going along with them and supporting me.
And yeah, many more. You too. Appreciate it.
Very proud of you. Love you. And that's it for today's episode of Spaces Unscripted. I would say you can follow Gary on all of his socials, but he's not a big numbers guy, not big social media
That's
guy.
Right. Yeah.
You can follow me, and I don't know, maybe I'll put him up there every once in a while. Thank you so much for watching, and I will see you again soon. Bye.